491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 316. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
So this week we're going to be talking about three sort of left-leaning but not left politicians in the United States, all became governors of their states at various points, who were active around the turn of the century. Two of them were active in the 1880s and 1890s, which is a period we talked quite a bit about on the most recent episode of the show. And then also another one was somewhat active in that time period as well, but was more active toward the end of the sort of progressive era and was active in post-turn of the century politics, but again, following in a similar legacy. As usual, as always, arsenalfordemocracy.com. With each episode, we put up a PDF that has our notes and sources. For this week, there's definitely a lot of Wikipedia information that we've got on these three, but we have rounded it out with various other sources, especially because in one of the cases, the Wikipedia page was not actually that accurate, unfortunately, when I was going over it, so I had to supplement it with other sources and more accurate sources. So Kelly, we'll go to you first to talk about Hazen S. Pingree, the mayor of Detroit and then governor of Michigan.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So like many historical figures that are interesting, I think Pingree happens to be super interesting because he didn't become what you think he would become based on his biography. He was born in Maine and he started a shoe company, the Pingree and Smith Shoe Company, that by the 1890s was the largest shoe manufacturer in the American West. So he came into quite a bit of fortune and wealth as part of this business he started with Charles Smith. But that's not where the story ends. He didn't sort of become a shoe magnet and then just live out his days. Pingree was, like I mentioned, was born in New England in Maine, but he ended up in Michigan, and that is where he set down his roots, both with his business and his political roots, where he went on to become both mayor of Detroit and governor of Michigan. He actually was such a Michigander that he tried to do both jobs at once, but that didn't quite work out, and we will get to that in a moment. So Pingree didn't really plan on becoming a politician, but was essentially recruited by the GOP to run for mayor of Detroit. And when he did run for mayor and he became mayor, he really sort of just got to work. He saw all of the problems that were plaguing the city. He was especially against corporate monopolies, and he really led what became a national crusade, or at least nationally visible crusade, against some of the sort of public services in Detroit, including gas, streetcar, electric, and telephone companies that were run by monopolies at the time. Despite being such a wealthy individual, he really sort of gained favor, or continued to gain favor, with the people of Detroit by successes against these monopolies, such as rate reductions for some of these utilities that we would now consider public utilities, like gas and electric. And he actually won approval for a citizen-owned electric light plant and really began to speak nationally on the importance of this citizen ownership, municipal ownership of public utilities. So Pingree was mayor during the 1893 Depression, which we talked in last week's episode about really the horrors of that depression and just the number of people who really starved and went hungry during that depression. So Pingree had one of his more famous ideas, which he called his Potato Patch Plan. He initially financed the plan and even sold his prize horse to pay for the farming tools for this project. And under this project, members of the city of Detroit got plots of Detroit in which they could farm, particularly potatoes, but other items as well. And while reading through this plan, I couldn't help but thinking about the conversations currently happening in Detroit, which just has more land than it needs, given it the shrinking of its population, and the current plans and projects to turn empty lots into these community gardens. So Pingree was really way ahead of us on community gardens. And this scheme, which in this information is actually found on the Smithsonian Institute's Community Gardens website, I'm going to read a bit from the site. During the first year, Pingree and his allies were able to garner enough support to acquire 430 acres of land to temporarily use for cultivation on the outskirts of the city. The Agricultural Committee plowed and harrowed the land and staked it off into numbered parcels that range from 1/4 to a half acre. To ensure participation, many were compelled to apply for the program under the threat of not receiving charity relief from the city if they did not participate. 2/3 of the lots were generally planted with potatoes, but the gardeners also raised beans, squash, pumpkins and string beans, cabbage, cucumbers, corn, and beets. While by no means reaching all of the unemployed, the program was a relative success. In 1894, 975 families raised $14,000 worth of crops on 430 acres of land. By 1897, the program in Detroit reached its peak with 1,563 families participating. So this was of course, it didn't save every person in Detroit who was hungry and jobless as a result of the Depression, but it did put a dent in it for some families. And the program drew national attention and then was spread across the country, including delegations from Buffalo and Boston visiting Detroit to see this project and try to apply it in their own city. So during his time as mayor in Detroit, he really became known not only for this potato patch project, but also for the national conversations he led around municipal ownership and public regulation of utilities and streetcars. He was so successful that he became the GOP's candidate for governor of Michigan in 1896. And he really campaigned on a platform of trying to bring in as many ethnic groups as he could, including Germans. He really wanted to sort of build a big umbrella under which many people could stand, and he advertised himself as working for the prosperity of everyone and advocated heavily against the civil rights. In 1896, not only did he win the governorship for himself, but he also helped William McKinley win the state as a presidential candidate. So after he became the governor of Michigan, he tried to retain his seat as mayor of Detroit at the same time. He had one more year left serving as mayor of Detroit, and he thought that he could do both jobs for a year. Unfortunately for him, this went to the Michigan Supreme Court, which ruled against him, and he ended up resigning as mayor of Detroit. As governor, he continued to fight for the same things that he fought for as mayor. He wanted to further regulate railroad rates. He wanted to continue to increase municipal ownership of public utilities. He also fought for a number of progressive labor measures, including an 8-hour workday, the abolition of child labor, arbitration and labor disputes, an income tax. So in all of these ways, he sort of continued to expand on his progressive nature as governor of Michigan. Unfortunately, the business-oriented Republicans and Democrats blocked many of his proposals. So even within his own party, there was resistance to his progressive views. He certainly did not accomplish everything that he set out to accomplish in his 4 years of governor, but he sort of continued to contribute to this brand of Midwest progressive politics and really sparked a lot of the national conversations that continue, not only about community gardens, but also about who should own these public utilities. One of his more famous expressions was, "I do not condemn corporations in Richmond, but I would keep them within their proper spheres. It is not safe to entrust the government of the country to the influence of Wall Street, which I think is especially interesting given his own background as a very successful businessman. But he seemed to really separate that and separate what would have been best for him personally and perhaps his bottom line as his business, with really trying to build a coalition of citizens and government that really worked for the people. And he cast as wide a net as possible when running for office. He was successful and well-liked across Detroit and across Michigan. And he really worked on behalf of the people to address the problems of the day in the middle of this incredibly difficult economic period.
One interesting tidbit from the Wikipedia page. So he didn't seek re-election as governor. He only served one term of 4 years. And then he went on an international trip and he ended up passing away of various health complications while he was in London. And he was, I guess, famously at the time, a lookalike for the King of Britain, King Edward VII. And I looked and compared the two photos and yeah, they pretty much do look the same, but I guess he had a doppelganger thing going. When he fell ill in London, King Edward did send some doctors to him as a gesture. And unfortunately, they were not able to save him. Rachel, did you have thoughts and reactions to Kelly's section on Mayor and Governor Hazen Pingree?
I'm just really impressed by his crusades about public utility and municipal regulation of these utilities, especially like telephone companies, which still to this day are privately owned. And I think that's something that we should look to, especially in this time when telecommunications are so important and so ubiquitous. And also, I think streetcar definitely extends to like our previous episodes talking about how we should have public regulation of the airline industry. So I think that's something, that's a conversation that we're still having to this day, like who should own and who should regulate these utilities and these industries.
I guess one thing I was thinking along similar lines is that you can kind of see why the business Democrats and business Republicans were so united in trying to stop him, which is a theme we're going to keep hearing in this episode. In the legislature, they were united in trying to stop him because these were good ideas that were super popular and they remain good ideas to this day. And that was unacceptable. So they had to stop them then and there. I don't know if that's why he decided not to run for re-election. Maybe he knew that he wasn't in very good health, but he may have just decided it's not really working out for me. And actually, all three of these guys that we're talking about today are one-term governors. In one case, there was a constitutional limit, but in all of the cases, they were only able to serve one term, and they had these big ambitions that were unfortunately not necessarily realized, and generally all either were still good ideas to present day, or were ideas that everyone eventually came around to later on and realized were good ideas that needed to be adopted. So, Rachel, we're going to turn now to John P. Altgeld, the progressive to left-leaning governor of Illinois, who we briefly alluded to when we talked about the Haymarket bombing on some previous episodes. The reason for that, as you'll talk about, is that he issued a pardon for those who had not yet been executed for that. Altgeld's a really interesting figure. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about his background and how he eventually rose to the governorship of Illinois.
Yeah. John P. Altgeld was born in Niederselters in Germany, which was at that time in the Duchy of Nassau. But he moved to America at a very young age, I believe he was 3 months old. His parents took him to the United States as the revolutions of 1848 kicked off. So he was a Granger Movement Democratic Republican. He spent 1 year as a prosecutor in Missouri, and he resigned pretty quickly after that. And he was convinced that the criminal justice system and the penal system were worsening the problem of crime and producing hardened criminals, not rehabilitated members of society. In 1884, he published Our Penal Machinery and Its Victims. He campaigned in 1884 as an Illinois Democrat, and he nearly won a congressional race in a solidly Republican district in Illinois. He had an anti-tough-on-crime platform, which sounds pretty mind-boggling today, and he dramatically outperformed the previous Democratic nominee, who was much better known than Altgeld. In 1886, he was elected as a superior court judge in Cook County, Illinois. On both the ballot lines of the Dems and the short-lived local United Labor Party. This was an impressive feat given the level of public turbulence that year over the Haymarket bombing and trial. He unsuccessfully sought the legislators' indirect election to U.S. Senate in 1890. He was nominated for governor in 1892. He was very popular among downstate Illinois voters and media outlets, perhaps because of his time in Missouri, and among German Americans and left sympathizers in Chicago. This was all despite English language press vilifying him in all but one paper. He was called the poor man's friend during the 1892 campaign, although he was by that point a millionaire from real estate and he owned several buildings in Chicago. He attacked the Republican incumbent for using prison labor on state projects, continuing his talk against the criminal justice system and the penal system as it existed at that time. He was elected, becoming the first immigrant governor of Illinois and the first Chicago resident to win the governorship. He nearly died of poor health right after the election, but he did survive. As governor, he spearheaded the nation's most progressive child labor and occupational safety laws. He appointed women to important positions in the state government, and he vastly increased state funding for education. One thing he was really well known for, in June 1893, he pardoned the remaining people convicted falsely for the Haymarket bombing. Several of them had already been executed. The pardon order contains a very long and extremely detailed examination of the facts surrounding the case and reviews the trial itself. This was to prove that the pardon was clearly justified. Nevertheless, in the press, he was kind of painted as a radical monster who was pro-murderous anarchist terrorists. This perception was spread nationally, which pretty quickly thrust him into infamy. He became famous, but really denigrated. There's the full text of the pardon, and in it he really does mention like the jury was a packed jury. It was just a really it was a kangaroo court that really convicted the Haymarket bombers.
I think we talked about on a previous episode that the people who were charged were not actually, there was no evidence that they were actually involved in the bombing. They were just being charged with essentially murder on the basis that they had allegedly incited the act, which, I mean, that is, first of all, that's a false charge, like, because it wasn't an incitement charge. It was that they were actually being charged for the crime itself. Mm-hmm. But secondly, like, that's just not, like, you know, there wasn't even necessarily evidence that that incitement itself was an accurate thing if that had been what they had been charged with.
Right. And I think several people weren't even there in Haymarket Square at the time of the bombing, and they were just kind of swept up and put on trial.
Yeah,
they
were just sort of mass arrests of German American anarchists in mm-hmm. in Chicago.
Yeah. So despite his attempts at really analyzing why he was pardoning the falsely convicted people, he just was really painted as kind of a an agitator who was pro anarchy and pro terrorism.
Again, remember, this is a guy who's a millionaire from real estate. I mean, you know, maybe he's not a shoe tycoon like the previous guy we were talking about, but like, he's not a, you know, he may have started out from humble origins, you know, on a poor farm or whatever, but he was definitely part of elite circles himself. As far as I could tell, he wasn't like involved in anarchist circles or anything like that. And he also took pains in the, I don't know if you noticed this, in the pardon order at the beginning, it says this isn't like, he wasn't pardoning them out of nowhere either, because a lot of people had petitioned him, including, I think he talks about, like, merchants and respected business owners and that sort of thing. Like, this, like, he takes pains to go through the respectability politics of saying, like, look, very respected members of our community, you know, upstanding citizens, not anarchists or whatever, have petitioned and said that this was a miscarriage of justice. And as I said, and as you said, it's a very long pardon document on the whole. It takes so many pains at so many points to make very clear why this is the correct thing to do, not just morally, but also legally the correct thing to do. And none of it mattered. Just from then on, he was the anarchist governor, or as we'll talk about later, the communist governor.
Right. Another thing that kind of thrust him into the spotlight is his opposition to President Cleveland's use of federal troops to break the Pullman strike, unlike most of his peer governors. He did deploy state militias during the crisis to allow non-striking workers to move trains unimpeded, and in some instances they did violently clash with the worker crowds, but he did bar them from being used to guard private property from destruction, and he did not allow them to be used as scab workers. So despite this, he was routinely denounced in the local and national press and by political opponents as a murderous anarchist or, quote, the ambitious and unscrupulous Illinois communist. That was in Harper's Weekly during his 1896 reelection bid. Others simply attacked him with comparisons to John C. Calhoun for his Federalist or states' rights approach to the Pullman strike and his fruitless insistence that the president could not deploy U.S. troops domestically. He was swept out of office after helping to break Democratic unity by publicly opposing Cleveland during and after the strike in the 1896 Republican wave year that saw McKinley elected president. Teddy Roosevelt, who 4 years later would be elected vice president on McKinley's second ticket, came to Illinois specifically to tear apart Altgeld's reelection bid and campaign for McKinley in the state. Roosevelt hinted in one speech in 1896 that Altgeld and William Jennings Bryan would need to be shot by a firing squad like the end of the Paris Commune of 1871 in order to prevent a social revolution in the United States. He said, Mr. Altgeld is a much more dangerous man than Bryan. He's much slyer, much more intelligent, much less silly, much more free from all the restraints of public morality. The one is unscrupulous from vanity, the other from calculation. The one plans wholesale repudiation with a light heart and bubbly eloquence because he lacks intelligence. The other would connive at wholesale murder and would justify it by elaborate and cunning sophistry for reasons known only to his own torturous soul. For America to put men like this in control of her destiny would be such a dishonor as it is scarcely bearable to think of. So Roosevelt was obviously threatened by Altgeld and Bryan during this time.
Also, again, to underscore this one more time, the idea that, oh, you know, who knows why he did this pardon? He must be these dastardly reasons in his heart known only to himself. Read the pardon, dude. Like, it's all there. He wrote it out. He told you exactly why he did it. There's nothing mysterious about it. But they, you know, that wasn't propaganda. Just you could say whatever you wanted.
Right. Definitely not subtle in any way. Altgeld did somewhat inadvertently help William Jennings Bryan obtain the presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago by championing the Silver Clause nationally and ensuring the convention would be filled with anti-gold standard delegates. Although Altgeld was backing Missouri Congressman Richard P. Bland, who was the favorite at the convention's start. Altgeld commented to Clarence Darrow, "That is the greatest speech I ever listened to. I don't know, but its effect will be to nominate him." Isn't that about the
cross of gold speech? Yes.
Yeah. Altgeld retained the Illinois delegates for Bland for several ballots, I believe 5 ballots, but eventually had to yield them to Bryan after the delegation as a block was ready to flip. Altgeld himself, although pretty famous, he was never eligible for the presidency due to being born in Germany. He later tried unsuccessfully twice to run for mayor of Chicago as a municipal ownership third-party candidate against the incumbent conservative Democrat with the hope of splitting the vote and allowing a, quote, less offensive Republican in. So he was definitely a very progressive governor who unfortunately was continuously slandered by both local and national press as an anarchist, as a terrorist, as a communist. And what he did wasn't really that radical by even the standards of the time. So it's really unfortunate that he wasn't able to continue as governor of Illinois after his first term.
Yeah, and I think that it was the right thing to do, doing the Haymarket pardon, but that was in June of 1893, and he had only taken office in, I think, January of 1893. So that was one of his sort of first, his earlier acts as governor, and it sort of set the tone for the rest of the term. And, you know, he was working on things like progressive child labor laws, occupational safety laws, as you said, and improving state education funding. But, like, I think that he kind of just really struggled after the Haymarket pardon on a lot of fronts with dealing with the legislature and so forth. Although, again, as you said, not actually pushing particularly radical agenda. I mean, this was all stuff that was generally, you know, within, say, 20, 30, 40 years was like relatively mainstream position, if not already adopted. And nevertheless, seemed to, you know, not really have that impact. I did think it was really interesting, too, the thing that he was, like, able to really... Because the previous guy we talked about, Hazen Pingree, did a lot of outreach to German Americans who were this huge political bloc in the Midwest and, you know, to some degree still are even today, but especially were at the time. And we've talked about the Illinois German communities in particular before, but Pingree was reaching out as, you know, a Yankee of English stock. Altgeld was himself reaching out as German. I'm assuming that he probably spoke German, given that he was born in Germany. And even though he moved when he was, you know, 3 or 4 months old to the United States, his parents, I think, were probably speaking German at home, based on what little I was able to find about them. Also, you know, he is absolutely part of a very specific generation, or I guess given his age, basically the offspring generation of that generation, of the huge wave of German Americans or German immigrants to the United States who came because of the 1848 revolution. A lot of people left after that. His parents, as far as I could sort of piece together from the timeline, just bailed out immediately as soon as stuff started happening. They did not wait to see what the outcome was going to be. Niederselters, which Rachel mentioned was his birthplace, was this very tiny village in the Duchy of Nassau. This was an area that it took me a while to piece together because the German principalities were very confusing in this time period, because this was before the unification of Germany, obviously. This was a village that was sort of sandwiched between or around, you know, 4 or 5 different things. There was like the Grand Duchy of Hesse, the Duchy of Nassau, the Free City of Frankfurt, the Kingdom of Prussia's territories in the area. There was a whole bunch of different like sovereign territories, independent states, and they all handled the crises of 1848 differently from each other. The Duchy of Nassau, the approach that the Duke there took was to basically say, yes, I'll accede to all of your demands. And then as soon as people were sort of burned out and the revolution was fading away, he said, psych, and pulled it all back. Nearby, though, there was a lot of turbulence in the neighboring Grand Duchy of Hesse, where the Grand Duke there actually had to abdicate as a result of the pressures of the revolutions of 1848. So a lot of Germans left either during or shortly after this crisis and formed a very specific community, even within the broader German immigrant and first or second generation communities that was already in the United States at that point. And that is the community that Altgeld grows up in, you know, technically born in Germany, but effectively a first generation American within that community, and was able to therefore bridge this very important gap. again, just to keep the timelines in everybody's minds here. Hazen Pingree was the mayor of Detroit in the years preceding when we're talking about with Altgeld being governor. And then Altgeld loses re-election for governor of Illinois in 1896, the same year that Pingree becomes the governor of Michigan across the lake. Kelly, your thoughts on Governor Altgeld?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm still really interested by the fact that, and sort of amazed by the fact that he spent 1 year as a prosecutor, and this informed his opinion of our penal system in a way that sort of led him to run for governor and really continue to act on those values and the lessons learned. I think while we have certainly come to on things like child labor laws and an 8-hour workday, we still haven't caught up with him on our understanding of the harm caused by our criminal justice system. Again, I'm really amazed that such a wealthy individual who, you know, was so successful in business and was able to sort of reach back and think more about these bigger values and the kind of society and the kind of state that he wanted to live in, and acted with such courage when it came to issues of the criminal justice system, and spoke out on things that are still not spoken out on today.
All right, so that brings us to our third lefty politician we're going to be talking about. This one, a little bit later, he had tried to enter politics during this same time period, but was initially unsuccessful. So he didn't make his comeback until much later. I think his first elected office was actually the governor of Indiana, which he was elected to in 1908. But he had been sort of, you know, kind of known in some of the party circles, I guess, up to that point. He, in contrast with the two previous guys that we talked about, both the guys that we talked about started from humble backgrounds, you know, were involved in the Civil War. They were part of that generation and then made their fortunes and then, you know, became these powerful politicians. Thomas R. Marshall is our third guy, Indiana attorney. I don't think he was particularly wealthy, and certainly, I mean, a lot of these guys had money problems at various points, but I think Marshall probably was kind of the hardest up the whole time. He subsequently, as we'll talk about, went on to become vice president of the United States, but they really did not pay very much to the vice presidents at the time, and he even had to was required to pay for his own repairs to the official automobile that he was chauffeured around in as the vice president of the United States, and that was a genuine financial hardship for him. So Marshall is an interesting figure as the governor of Indiana, and obviously an interesting figure as the vice president of the United States. What I want you to keep in mind, this is going to be jumping ahead slightly, but what I want you to keep in mind as you're listening to this description, which I'm just going to, for the governorship description, I'm going to read from the Wikipedia page, but I certainly consulted other sources as well. Keep in mind that this is the guy who was Woodrow Wilson's vice president when Woodrow Wilson almost died of a debilitating stroke in the fall of 1919, when he had more than a year left on his second term as president. So this is something to bear in mind, that there is a potential, different history that transpires if this guy becomes the president of the United States instead of sort of fading into the background. I mean, who knows, as we'll talk about, who knows how much power he would have had as president if he had become president, but just bear that in mind. So, he served one term before he was term limited out by the Constitution of Indiana, one term as governor from 1909 to 1913. Marshall focused primarily on advancing the progressive agenda. He successfully advocated the passage of a child labor law and anti-corruption legislation. He supported popular election of U.S. senators, and the constitutional amendment to allow it was ratified by the Indiana General Assembly during his term. He also overhauled the state auditing agencies and claimed to have saved the government millions of dollars. He was unsuccessful in passing the rest of his progressive platform agenda items, which familiar to our two previous guys, or persuading the legislature to call a convention to rewrite the state constitution to expand the government's regulatory powers. And just to remind people, so the first guy we talked about today was a Republican, but the second two, including Marshall, were Democrats. Marshall was a strong opponent of Indiana's recently passed eugenics and sterilization laws and ordered state institutions not to follow them. He was an early high-profile opponent of eugenics laws in general and carried his opposition into the vice presidency. Keep that in mind as well. His governorship was the first in which no state executions took place due to his opposition to capital punishment and his practice of pardoning and commuting the sentences of people condemned to execution. So similar to some of the stuff we heard from Altgeld there, except that he apparently took less heat for his pardons in this slightly later time period. He regularly attacked corporations and used recently created antitrust laws to attempt to break several large businesses. Rewriting the state constitution became Marshall's central focus as governor, basically because he wasn't getting anywhere with the state legislature, and he was having trouble regulating some of these corporations. After the General Assembly refused to call a constitutional convention, he sought other ways to have a new constitution adopted. He and Jacob Piatt Dunn, a close friend and civic leader, wrote a new constitution that increased the state's regulatory powers considerably, set minimum wages, and gave constitutional protections to unions. Many of these reforms were also in the Socialist Party platform under its leader, Terre Haute native Eugene V. Debs. Republicans believed Marshall's constitution was an attempt to win over Debs supporters who had a strong presence in Indiana. The constitution also allowed direct democracy initiatives and referendums to be held. The Democratic-controlled assembly agreed to the request and put the measure on the ballot. His opponents attacked direct democracy provisions, claiming they were a violation of the United States Constitution, which required states to operate, quote, Republican forms of government. The 1910 elections gave the Democrats control of the Indiana Senate, increasing the Constitution's chances of adoption. Marshall presented it to the General Assembly in 1911 and recommended they submit it to voters in the 1912 election. However, subsequently, it was blocked by the from getting on the ballot by the courts after Republicans filed suit, and so it never came to pass. But it's interesting to think about what could have happened. And again, because this is something that I do know some about and we've talked about on the show before, a lot of these recommendations, like a minimum wage provision in the Constitution, corporate regulatory authority, direct democracy referendums, these were things that were being introduced. I mean, he was slightly ahead of the curve, maybe by a few years, or he was basically in parallel with states like, I think, Minnesota at the time, maybe, and some of the stuff that was happening in Massachusetts at the time. Most of this stuff within a generation or even half a generation was not seen as particularly radical and was certainly not seen as a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Obviously, many states have provisions like that now that are not in conflict with the U.S. Constitution. So sort of surprisingly, Marshall, you know, who was thinking, oh, maybe I'll run for Senate or something like that, he ends up getting, as he's about to leave office, he gets plopped onto the 1912 ticket at the presidential level as Woodrow Wilson's running mate for vice president to balance the ticket a bit. I'm about to get into, Wilson did not view it as an ideological balance, but I think some other people might have. And more importantly, geographic balancing to help deliver the key state of Indiana. Marshall, who very famously had a pretty cutting sense of humor, often self-deprecating, joked, "Indiana is the mother of vice presidents, home of more second-class men than any other state." As vice president, Marshall and President Wilson repeatedly clashed or simply parted ways. Often Marshall was just left out of the loop completely. Partly because Wilson and his clique were convinced that they were the progressives and the heirs to the progressive movement. But I would argue that Marshall was much more progressive. And I think the Wilson people believed, for whatever reason, that Marshall had been a conservative governor, despite all of what we just read off. Now, Marshall loyally campaigned for the ticket both times. He supported the World War I efforts after the war had been declared, although he wasn't very supportive beforehand. And he did, you know, run a few cabinet meetings during the Versailles conference while Wilson was in Europe. But he decided that he didn't really want to do that either. So the Secretary of State sort of became the de facto cabinet leader at various points while Wilson was away. Wilson wasn't really happy about that either. And that sort of followed a consistent trend with Marshall not really attending the cabinet meetings when Wilson was around, because he was like, well, I'm technically the president of the Senate, so I'm going to consider myself to be more part of the legislative branch. And also, no one listens to me or cares what I have to say. But again, to circle back to this point, which I think is a bit troubling, you know, if you think about stuff like fighting against child labor, trying to regulate child labor, fighting against eugenics laws, being this national outspoken voice against this concept of racial hygiene and eugenics and forced sterilization, those were things that Woodrow Wilson was into. Woodrow Wilson is often referred to even in present day as a progressive, but in so many ways, he was a huge reactionary. Just like doing the Federal Reserve, I don't think really qualifies you as a progressive when you are resegregating or initially segregating, however you want to look at it, the executive branch, enforcing military segregation during World War I, really promoting these, because Wilson, although he was governor of New Jersey, Wilson was from Virginia and was sort of a Southern figure in many ways. Wilson was a big time mega racist. You see the resurgence of the second rise of the Klan happen during this period. You see the Democratic Party being taken over in so many places, including the North, by the Klan during and after this period. And Marshall, a Democrat, stands against all of this and comes at it from the perspective of saying, hey, racism's bad, eugenics is bad, all of this is wrong, and this is not progressive. That had to be super annoying to Wilson and the people around him, who thought that eugenics was the next frontier in progressivism, that this was the future, a better way of organizing society, and that, you know, racial hygiene was a form of modern progress. That's not something that I found in a lot of the sources, but that's me reading between the lines, and especially that critical point that Wilson and his people were convinced that Marshall had been a conservative governor who was really kind of this throwback to, you know, oh, the ways of the past or whatever. And I think this is also something that comes up quite a lot especially in the Democratic Party, this conflict between the label of progressive and what you're actually advocating, because in some cases, a bunch of the young guns taking over the party, calling themselves progressive, not in the current era, but in the Wilson period, and especially in the 1980s and 1990s, the people that were calling themselves progressive often viewed themselves as progressive because they were leaving behind everything else. So remember, another key provision is that Marshall was trying to legalize and enshrine union rights, labor union rights in Indiana, where labor unions were particularly powerful, as we talked about with the presence of Debs and his supporters. People, like in the 1980s especially, you see this emergence and into the 1990s of self-styled progressives saying, we're taking up the mantle of the progressive movement of the Wilson days and so forth. And one of the key things is we've got to leave behind labor unions. This is an outdated mode, and the only progress forward is to leave behind labor unions. I don't think that would have been necessarily, it's hard to tell from our modern standpoint, was that a progressive thing at the time in the 1920s and in the 1910s and the aughts of the turn of the last century? Was that the progressive view or not? Were labor unions viewed as the future, or were they, or was there that same split between these sort of progressive reformists and the more militant, like trade unionists, who were certainly very strong at this time period, or the socialist parties at the time? So I think that's something to keep in mind as a potential source of tension, although they also just had various personality clashes that did not really get along. Marshall was generally regarded as a pretty good orator and a good conversationalist, but he tended to be a little bit more soft-spoken at times and a little bit more sometimes characterized as insecure in some ways, or just that he was more of the type, compared to Wilson, to sit back, listen to what everyone was saying, and then maybe say something, which he was not really given a position to do as vice president. There were some other funny moments as well, again, alluding to his humor. One of Wilson's allies, said of Marshall, an unfriendly fairy godmother presented him with a keen sense of humor. Nothing is more fatal in politics. And Marshall himself talked about this. Eventually, as vice president over his 8 years, he became known, oh, this is a funny guy. He makes jokes. They're actually pretty good jokes. But a lot of times people, especially when he was first vice president, didn't understand that he was making jokes, or he would say things and people just wouldn't get it. Later on, you know, he would say kind of, he would make snide asides, like while he was presiding over the Senate. He often found it frustrating that there were all these sort of powerful senators who all thought themselves, you know, these basically, you know, that by virtue of being in the Senate, this automatically made them the leading lights of the, you know, American political intellectuals and so forth, and that they didn't have to listen to him as the presiding officer, and that they could overrule him. There was one famous speech where a senator was going, you know, on and on, you know, what this country needs is this, and what this country needs is that. And Marshall leaned over and said, he says what this country needs is this, what this country needs is that, but what this country needs is a good 5-cent cigar. Which is apparently a reference to a comic strip in Indiana that he liked. And this became this national sensation because he got overheard saying it. But it took a while for his sense of humor to kind of catch on. There was an early story that he talked about. So he said that basically vice presidents, by the time he took office in 1913, had this whole collection of random odd jobs that they had been given, nameless and unremembered jobs, he called them. And he believed that these were concocted to keep vice presidents from doing any harm to their administrations, keep them busy, basically busy work. So one of these chores, this is in the Senate biography of him, one of these chores, according to Marshall, was that of regent of the Smithsonian Institution. The vice president went to his first board meeting, met the other regents, and these included the Chief Justice of the United States and the inventor Alexander Graham Bell. They were discussing the Smithsonian possibly funding an expedition to Guatemala to excavate for traces of prehistoric man. With the breezy manner of a self-described lighthearted Hoosier, Marshall asked the Smithsonian if they had ever considered excavating in Washington, D.C. Judging from the specimens walking around on the street, he said, they would not have to dig far below the Capitol to discover prehistoric man. Quote, and then the utter uselessness and frivolity of my vice presidency was disclosed, Marshall confessed, for not a man smiled. It was a year before I had the courage to open my mouth again. So you could, like, in my opinion, that's a pretty funny joke that still holds up. And it just went over really, really poorly because he was essentially dissing all of these famous and powerful people in the room. And that seemed to be a persistent problem that followed him around. So it's just to sort of wrap this up here. So after Wilson comes back from the Versailles conference, and then there's his sort of ongoing battle to try to get the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations approved, largely unsuccessfully, or at least not certainly well short of what Wilson was hoping, Marshall, drawing on at this point, you know, almost 2 full terms worth of working with the Senate and sitting in the Senate hearings and meetings and speeches and everything, and knowing all these senators as the presiding officer, Marshall kept trying to convince Wilson to accept various compromises to get Senate consent for his post-war agenda. He argued that a lot of the changes that were being or that could have secured it were not substantive changes. They were just changes to make a bunch of these egotistical senators feel like they had had a say in this big thing, as opposed to Wilson, you know, coming down with the Ten Commandment tablets from the, you know, Versailles conference and so forth. Wilson was unwilling to bend on this, and then eventually had his stroke in September 1919. This triggered then the 1919 to 1920 crisis. Now remember, the Constitution at this point did have a explicitly stated provision of inability to discharge presidential duties, meaning that the vice president should become the acting president. But up until this point, this had never been an issue. The president had just kicked the bucket and died or been assassinated or whatever. You had never had a situation where the president was completely like immobilized in bed, unable to speak and possibly completely out of it, which was the case for Wilson at the very least in the immediate aftermath of his stroke. And there was no 25th Amendment provision at this point. So later on, after JFK's assassination, you have the 25th Amendment, which creates various provisions where, for example, the president can sign a letter signing over his power to an acting president, for example, if he's going under anesthesia, or if the president, say, had another stroke and was unable to sign a letter like that, or maybe he goes into a coma or something, you can have the cabinet basically takes a vote and they write a letter to Congress saying the president is unable to discharge his duties. And then the vice president takes over as the acting president, although not the full president, until the president has actually passed away. But this was not in place at the time. Interestingly, though, had it been, he would have been able to become president or acting president at this point, because at least initially, no one was allowed to see the president. The clique around him, including the new first lady, were very protective of Wilson and not letting anyone see him. And Marshall was, in fact, shocked when finally someone from Wilson's inner circle got word to him that said, hey, you need to be ready in case he dies, because there's a very good chance that he's going to die. But they weren't willing to admit that publicly. And Marshall was very reluctant to push the matter because he didn't want to look like he was, you know, some scheming, conniving guy that was trying to stab Wilson in the back and assume the presidency. I think he very delicately put it in one communication conversation to a top Wilson person from the inner circle. He said, you know, it would be this enormous tragedy if Wilson passes away. It would be an even greater tragedy if he passes away so suddenly that I have no idea that it's coming and I'm not ready to take over the presidency, if that's what needs to happen. And the Wilson people, because they already didn't like Marshall and they didn't agree with him ideologically, they were totally trying to box him out. The cabinet kept on having meetings, not involving Marshall, though, because Marshall thought it was inappropriate since the president was supposed to run the meetings unless he couldn't, and they hadn't definitively established whether or not he couldn't. One of the cabinet leaders, the Secretary of State, ended up getting fired over that. And the cabinet meetings, they basically concluded the president is incapacitated, the acting president should take over. And Marshall said, well, I still don't know. So they went to Congress, and Congress said, well, the president seems incapacitated and we're not getting any word on his situation. And members of both parties pretty much agreed Vice President Marshall should take over as acting president. This did not come to pass. And eventually the inner circle managed to do some sort of Weekend at Bernie's style thing by some accounts, or maybe other accounts say that Wilson actually partially recovered. And it was enough that they were able to convince him that President Wilson was actually in charge, even if he was in bed for the rest of his presidency, you know, that he was signing the letters and executive orders and stuff, and that it wasn't just his wife running the country, although it definitely was. But it's still unclear on how severe his sort of incapacitation was. But that dissipated the crisis, and Marshall never ended up taking over. So I guess I'll go to you, Rachel, first. Any thoughts on this guy?
I'm really impressed by how during his governorship, he kind of put a moratorium on capital punishment, the death penalty. That's something that we're still reckoning with today. And although many states have banned either informally or formally the death penalty, that's something that still many states have on the books. So I'm really impressed by how progressive he is in that aspect.
Kelly, your feedback?
One thread I see between all three of these figures in the Midwest is their ability and willingness to sort of grow their following and include new groups that had formerly not been included. And I'm especially struck with that here, because of Woodrow Wilson's legacy. I know we have a Woodrow Wilson High School in DC that is very seriously considering being renamed because of his horrible legacy when it comes to race. And the fact that Marshall was sort of was in the building, but not invited to the table here, I think just reinforces that Wilson's poor legacy when it comes to race relations, because Marshall was so outspoken for the time on matters of eugenics.
Yeah, well, I think the immediate comparison that comes to my mind, which you were not on this episode, but Rachel would remember this, is when we did our episode on Harry Lane, the U.S. Senator from Oregon, who was serving in this exact time period. He took office at around the same time in 1913 as Marshall took office as vice president, and he passed away in 1917. he was speaking in the Senate vociferously in support of indigenous rights, vociferously against joining World War One and war in general, vociferously against imperialism by the United States, and speaking out against racism and segregation and things like that, making himself this hated figure among the Southern senators and so forth. And what this emphasizes between Harry Lane and Marshall is this point that is so critical to keep making, which is that the excuse is, well, it was a different time back then, and this is just how people thought. And it's like, no, this was how the people in charge thought, but there were these voices, even at the prominent highest levels of the U.S. Senate and the vice presidency, speaking out vocally in this same time period, saying, this is wrong, and this is something that has to be emphasized. It is not true that, oh, things were just different back then. In the same way that during, you know, the worst of Spanish colonial slavery in the Caribbean in like the 1500s and 1600s, there were people in Spain writing publicly saying that slavery was an abomination that had to be abolished. This is something that you can find all throughout history, is that you can say, well, this may have been the prevailing attitude, or at least the prevailing attitude of the ruling class, but that does not mean that there were not people at these same levels of power, although, as you said, not at the table in many cases on making the decisions, who were speaking out against these things. All right, Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Rachel, thanks for being on the show as well.
Thanks, Bill.